Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Musician Randy Bachman has both shaped the sound of popular music over the past 50 years and served as one of its leading fans and curators, a living torchbearer for many eras of rock and roll. A guitarist, songwriter, performer, and producer who penned countless hits for the Guess Who and Bachman Turner Overdrive, Bachman has been the host of Vinyl Tap on satellite radio since 2005, where you can hear his stories of a lifetime in music and the songs he treasures. Bachman grew up in Winnipeg in the 1950s, addicted to radio. It wasn't long before he put down his violin and picked up a guitar. Bachman has been taking care of business ever since, selling millions of records and often dominating the radio waves that were once his connection to a world beyond Canada. He continues to record and tour today and has collected the tales from his decades on the road in a new book, Vinyl Tap Stories. Randy Bachman, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the Roundtable.
Thanks, Ian, and what a great intro. That about encapsulated my whole life.
Well, I hope not, because I want to ask you about it. Why were you so addicted to radio when you started out?
Well, being in Winnipeg, which is like the center of nowhere or the center of everywhere, it's right in the center of Canada or North America, there's nothing near it. So radio was our link to the outside world. And being at the top of the Great Plains, late at night I had this little tiny rocket radio that didn't even have a dial on it. It had an ear plug you put in your ear, like, because it was mono, you put one plug in your ear. So you can hide it under your pillow, and your parents didn't know you were listening to the radio. And you plug this into your wall outlet, and you listen. And I listened to WLS in Chicago and WNOE in New Orleans and in Shreveport, Louisiana, stations you would never normally get, except at night when everything quieted down, and these big 50,000-watt stations would broadcast, and I'd hear the most incredible music. So I was really addicted to that music. I told Neil Young about it. He got a little rocket radio, and he'd listen to it, and we went to different high schools, but we'd meet every Saturday downtown in a restaurant and say, did you listen Tuesday night? And at, you know, 20 after 2, they played that great song and all that kind of stuff. And so we learned a lot from hearing that. Then as we started our own bands and started making our own music, the DJ was our keyhole to the world, and I really appreciated the job they did. And in those days, you were friends with the DJs. You would pull into town and knock on the door of the studio, go in and play them the record. They'd like it. They'd put it on, just like you see in those old rock and roll movies with Alan Freed and Bill Haley and Chuck Berry and stuff. And radio was kind of wide open then. And it was the entertainment. This is like, you know, TV was kind of just starting, but there's only one TV channel, and you've got to be at home in front of your TV to watch it. Radio is and was and still and will always be everywhere. It's portable. You could take it everywhere. And for me, after many, many years, to suddenly you have a chance to do my own radio show on CBC, which is a lot like NPR, and then have it on satellite in the States and have millions and millions of listeners every week, has really been an incredible treat for me and a thrill to share all my old records and tell my own personal stories of when I met Little Richard or Tony Bennett or Duke Ellington or Lady Gaga or Madonna or Jeff Beck or whatever, just whatever record I play, I've got my own story of when I met these people, and or the writer or the producer of the record and things like that. And so I think that's what's given the radio show some legs.
You know, some of us had a similar experience growing up in love with music, trying it, and then we're now working in radio because we couldn't do music. When did you realize how good you were and how much potential you had?
Well, you've got to have the dream that you can be up there with the best. So, you know, when I'm inspired to put down my violin and play guitar because I see Elvis on TV, you get a can of what was called Dippity Doo at that time, which is no different than what kids use on their hair today for Mohawk, and you do an Elvis wave in your hair, and you're too young to have sideburns, but you try to emulate Elvis and copy Elvis or his guitar player, who is Scotty Moore, who's a great guitar player. And then you just keep doing that every minute of the day, and you dream of being like them, and one day you cut a record, and suddenly that record gets on the radio, and other kids are trying to be like you, and that's what my whole life has been about. Then trying to be Jimi Hendrix, then trying to be Eric Clapton, then trying to be Jimmy Page. Do you know what I mean? You've got to always have idols and people to kind of worship what they've done and the way they play and the way they perfect their art and the way they write their songs. And I've kind of done a little bit of it all, played guitar, sang, wrote the songs, produced the songs, and do a little bit of everything. And it's kept me very active in the music business. I've had a really great life, and I'm happy to share it with people and tell them because they love to hear the stories.
You know, you came up at a pivotal time for rock music because not only were the idols you were hearing and emulating landmark moments in music and in the history of rock as we look back on it now, but eventually these people were your contemporaries. I mean, you've already told us how you knew Neil back when you were both kids. And as your career kind of grew, many of the legends of music were just people you knew on the bus.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. The records that I loved and grew up with, I then get to play a show with Chuck Berry. I get to play with Jerry Lee Lewis. I get to play with Bo Diddley. I get to play with Dion and the Belmonts, you know, and on. I get to play with the Champs. I get to play with Tony Bennett. You get to play with all these guys sooner or later. They're all on different blues or rock or jazz festivals. And, you know, I just locked it away in my memory. And when I had a chance to do this radio show, and they said, what'll make your show different? And I said, I guess I'll play the same music as everybody else, but I'll tell my own stories that nobody knows except me. And how I met Gene Vincent, how he came to my house for Easter dinner, you know, because his gig was canceled because it was Easter and it was in Winnipeg and nobody's going to go out to a show on Easter Sunday, that kind of thing. And people go, wow, you met Gene Vincent? Yeah, I did. I met his whole band. I got a blue cap when he was Gene Vincent, the Blue Caps. And Elvis took TCB as his motto, and it's on his tombstone to this day. And it was Elvis who made me want to switch from violin to playing guitar. So there's all these cyclical things that go in circles in my life that I'm kind of amazed at, and I'm glad it amuses other people to hear them because it really is my life.
Did you learn anything about how to relate to the next generation of artists that came out after you were well established? I mean, I'm wondering who's going to have Randy Bachman's story someday.
Good question. I learned a lot from the humbleness, the niceness of Les Paul, Chet Atkins, Tal Farlow, Barney Kessel, the really great guitar players, Lenny Bro, Michael Hedges, the guys I met who were, and you realize, and they've even told me this, and I've passed it on. If you're a guitar player, that's all you are. You're a guy with a dream, and you want to play guitar. And it's an endless pit of learning and practicing and learning and practicing. There's so many styles of guitar and different guitars to plug into different amps or just play acoustically. It's an endless, wonderful thing to have into your life. And I can teach a guy who's 80, who's, you know, quite a bit older than me, a lick, and a kid who's 8 years old can teach me a lick. And trade licks, that's the greatest thing you could do. Every guitar player I've seen, I've traded licks with Chet Atkins, Les Paul, Jimmy Page, Jeff Beck, Eddie Van Halen, on and on and on. You hear a guy warming up in a dressing room, you knock on the door and go, wow, that's incredible, can you show me that? And they say, sure, and it's how they warm up. And I say, okay, I'll show you one of mine. And so you trade licks that way, and you go away going, wow, this is an Eddie Van Halen lick, or a Sammy Hagar lick, or a Ted Nugent lick, or a Tal Farlow lick, and I'm going to put it in my next solo on stage. And you try to do it on stage, and it makes your playing unboring, because it gets boring playing the same thing every night. So suddenly you're trying to inject a new little riff that Buddy Guy or B.B. King showed you the nuance of and how to play, and it just keeps everything kind of alive and chugging along.
Randy, you're most well known for time you spent in The Guess Who and in Bachman Turner Overdrive. Of course, you guys are now sort of back together and trying some new stuff out. How hard is it to keep a band together, or why is it so hard to keep a lineup straight?
It's virtually impossible. I think the bands that are together today, and there's a couple of them, like Rush from Canada, ZZ Top, Aerosmith, they're the same guys. They were smart enough when they hit the point of breaking up to unofficially break up. And that is not to go in the press and blab and say they've broken up. They just all went their own separate ways. They had pretty much played out their music. They had played out their heart and souls. When you're in a band, you give up a regular life, a girlfriend, family relationship, kids you went to school with, you give all that up. Everybody who comes to your concert with somebody they love goes home with that somebody they love. You go to your hotel room alone, and you spend many, many nights alone. And so you sooner or later you get fed up with that, and you get the money in the bank, or you not, you just get fed up with it, and you're totally broke. You say, I don't want this life. I want a normal 9-to-5 job and a life from, you know, 5 to midnight with my wife and kids, and you break up. The bands that did take a planned hiatus, like I said, ZZ Top and Aerosmith and Rush, they each go and buy their ranch or buy their boat and sail around the world and have their kids. You see that happening a lot with women today. They take a break and have kids, like J-Lo did and Beyonce. They take time out, have their child, Celine Dion, same thing, and their career's on hold, and they come back to it. The unfortunate thing when I left the Guess Who or BTO is we literally broke up. We had a big fight. They went on without me. We didn't all put each other on hold and say, let's go and take a year or two and get all this BS and crap and all the stuff we want to do out of our system, and let's meet again in 2 years on this same date and see if we want to make music together again. We didn't do that. Luckily, I did it with Burton Cummings a few years ago. I did it 4 or 5 years ago with Fred Turner. I'm turning with Fred Turner now again. We've healed up all the past. We realized we were both jerks at times and we're both great guys at times. Let's look at the time we were great guys and let's try to be great and not be jerks. And let's see how we can rock out. And I'm having so much fun touring now with Fred Turner. It's amazing. And we get to play all our BTO hits. I'll play a couple of Guess Who hits. Life is good.
Does that become easier as you get older?
Yeah, the older you get, you realize how... You know, when you're young, you're invincible and you're perfect. And the older you get, you realize, gee, I have an ache in my back. I have a sore foot. I have a headache. I've been a jerk at many times. And, gee, I could have done much better in that situation. When you're young, you tend to do knee-jerk reactions. When you get older, you tend to just say, I'm not going to react on that now. I'm not going to reply to that now. Give me a moment to think it over. And you think it over and you go, there's a better way to deal with this. And it does get, you do get better with age. Everything gets better with age.
I can't let you go without asking about the guest spot you did on The Simpsons, which is one of the funnier moments in the show. BTO is playing at a festival and Homer's demanding that you skip ahead to the chorus. How did that come about?
Well, amazingly enough, I come home. This is quite a bit before I had a laptop. I come home and out of my fax machine is coming a piece of paper. And it says, request to use You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet and Taking Care of Business on The Simpsons. And I was a big fan of The Simpsons. And so I call Sony, who was my publisher at the time, and say, yeah, that's great. So they want to use the songs on the show. And they say, yeah, and when can you do the show? And I said, what do you mean? They said, well, they want you to come and do a voice on the show. They're cartooning BTO at the Springfield, you know, band shell at their little party. And Homer's taking Bart down to see his favorite band, BTO. And I go, you're kidding. And they say, no. So I fly in and I do my voiceover. Fred Turner flies in. He does his voiceover. And we do that. And they treat us like Elvis. It's really great to go down and work with the Simpsons people. Matt Groening and his crew were absolutely amazing. But one thing that surprised me when I got there, the studio was empty. And I said, well, I want to meet Homer's voice, and I want to meet Yardley Smith and Rhoda, who, remember the TV show Rhoda from Mary Tyler Moore? Rhoda's sister was Marge Simpson's voice. I wanted to meet her. I forget
her
name.
Julie Kavner.
Julie, yeah, with a husky voice. I want to meet these people. I said, you'll meet them later, but if they were here now, you would be too intimidated. We've done this before, and you're too intimidated. So all you got to do is go out into the room alone and say hello, Springfield. I go, hello, Springfield. And say, that's great for us. Now pretend there's 20 people. And I go, hello, Springfield. Now pretend there's 200. Hello, Springfield. Now there's 2,000. Hello, now 20,000. I go, hello, Springfield. And it's a real, like, Spinal Tap moment, like, hello, Cleveland. They go, that's it, perfectly. Now say these other lines. And I say to them, now that we got your lines and we got Turner's lines, you can come back to a reading where they're all sitting around the table and they read the script for the first time. And the writers are there to see if the actors really laugh at their own lines across the table and each other's lines. And if they don't, then they rewrite the script. So I go back for another reading, which is really great. And they were totally right. If I was there, I would have been intimidated because the guy next to me is doing three voices. He's doing Hapu or Haku, and he's doing all the voices. And then there's somebody else doing three or four voices. And then Yardley Smith comes in literally in bunny slippers, you know, with rabbit's ears on them and a dress coat. And her hair in rollers, and she lived about two blocks from the studio in Burbank, and she just shuffled down to do this little quick reading and ran home because she had another appointment later that day. And you see that there's just normal people there that have this talent of incredible voice characteristics that, you know, fit the cartoons. And so that was a real experience. And then at Christmas, I got a Christmas present from Homer and Marge and the kids from the Simpsons, like they were a real family. And then it was a Simpsons jacket and a clock and a game and T-shirts. So they had actually sent me an actual Christmas present, which was stunning to get and fabulous. So that was one of the most wonderful experiences of my life. And then Fred Turner has a cell in his house, and I have a cell, you know, which is one of the cartoon things they draw of you being on the show, autographed by Matt Groening. I have the script autographed by Matt, and it was a wonderful moment in my life. My son was on tour at the time. He had a big hit called She's So High in the 90s. Pandy called me and said, "Dad, I'm in Japan touring. You won't believe it, what they're doing with me and my song, and it's really great and all this stuff. What are you doing?" And I said, "I just did The Simpsons." And he said, "Wow, you finally made it." To him, I had finally made it, being on The Simpsons. After all the records and all the Guess Who and BTO thing, suddenly being on The Simpsons. And basically, he was right. I had finally made it. I made it into another world outside of rock and roll, the world of The Simpsons, which is known around the world.
Who are those pleasant old men?
It's BTO. They're Canada's answer to ELP. Their big hit was TCB. That's how we talked in the 70s. We didn't have a moment to spare.
Hello, Springfield! We're going to play all your old favorites. But first, we'd like to dip into our new CD.
Taking care of business!
Don't worry, sir. We'll get to that
one. No talking! No new crap! Taking care of business now! Get to the work in overtime, Clark!
Unbelievable.
Dumbass.
Work out! Nothing yet.
We just did.
Whatever.
Well, that's just one of the stories that you share in your new book, Vinyl Tap Stories. We've been speaking with Randy Bachman of Bachman Turner Overdrive and the Guess Who, and his radio show of the same title airs on satellite. Randy, a real pleasure to have you on, and thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.